a Trump government gives to reform is precisely that it is exempted from any serious criticism about Brexit, because the government feels that as we said at the beginning, that the government can't move in or speak sympathetically at all about the membership of the EU because of the hostility towards the EU in the current Washington administration.
Welcome to the latest podcast of the Federal Trust. Today, I'll be discussing with the chair of the Federal Trust, John Stevens, Anglo-American, Anglo-EU relations. And we're going to take as our starting point the, to me, surprising observation of the Europe Minister, the Labour Europe Minister, Nicholas Thomas Symonds, that he couldn't believe that in his lifetime, the United Kingdom would rejoin the European Union. We all remember that Keir Starmer said something similar just before the general election, but he, of course, is something like 20 years older than his Europe minister. So it marks a very definite development in the European, in the Labour Party as the party of Brexit, one of the parties of Brexit. John, why do you think the minister formulated his ideas in such categorical terms, and why now?
Well, I think this is part of a much bigger picture, which is the great fear that now pervades the British government, and also indeed governments on the continent in the EU, towards the US administration and towards President Trump, and confirmed in a way by the form and the necessity of this second unprecedented state visit by President Trump to the United Kingdom. The MAGA movement, the MAGA revolution in America, is profoundly opposed to the EU, and the grip that the United States has over British security, the British economy, particularly at a time of increasing vulnerability. And I'm thinking here about the problems which we have in the gilt market and with our debt levels, with financing that. There is tremendous sensitivity and fear, mounting almost to panic in some respects, about the influence of the US. And therefore, any suggestion that we might be wishing to get closer to the EU at this stage, after the very modest moves that have already been made, that is really something which the British government wishes to avoid.
It sounds as if you think that the British government, Keir Starmer's government, which had hoped to have its cake and eat it, to have a good relationship with the European Union and with the USA, has now decided it can't have its cake and eat it, and it's made a decision which is not necessarily a decision that the majority of the British electorate would endorse, of taking the American rather than the European option. Is that correct?
Not entirely. I think they have decided that they can't make any more progress in a European direction now, and that they are in a position of unprecedented vulnerability vis-a-vis the United States administration. And this vulnerability, as I say, primarily economic, but it is also, of course, the dimension which affects the EU as well, and which is the reason why the EU negotiating position on trade with Trump was so feeble, actually, in the last analysis. Is the shadow of Ukraine, the shadow of Putin, and the risk of to our security there, and the dependence which remains for the time being for Europe, including the UK, on US nuclear deterrence vis-a-vis Russia.
But it does seem to be the case that, that within the European Union, attempts are being made. I'd be interested to know how valid you think these attempts are, to work towards what they call strategic autonomy. Is that going to work? Is that going to create a different set of calculations for the United Kingdom?
Oh, I think it will, yes. I think this moment of weakness for Europe, in the strategic sense, in the military sense, vis-a-vis Russia, is a temporary one, because the European rearmament, which is now underway, is an enormous one. And it does include, although this is not something which is much discussed, a significant nuclear dimension, a tactical nuclear dimension, because that is the gap in our defence capability. The UK and the French in particular have a doomsday deterrence system, but the gap which only the Americans currently fill is the fear that Putin would use tactical nuclear weapons against, say, the Baltics or Poland, and that's what is causing the current need to continue to keep the Americans on board in the confrontation over Ukraine. But this will pass, and it could pass quite quickly. I think that the strategic independence, certainly from a nuclear point of view, of the EU, of the Europeans, and how precisely it's structured and arranged is, of course, an enormous question. But that is not likely to last very long. 3 or 4 years is what we're looking at. The British position is completely different because our dependence on the United States is, firstly, in our nuclear deterrent, but also, of course, in our economy. And the penetration of US economic interests in our economy is enormous. It's far greater than that of any other European country. We are in a totally different category. And that's even before we consider the whole historical dimension and the unity of language and everything else.
But how do you see foresee the next 3 or 4 years working out in the interaction between what you say will be a developing defence identity for the European Union and the United Kingdom? Will the United Kingdom at some point want to switch horses away from the United States towards the EU? Or perhaps the minister is just being realistic when he says that it will be his lifetime before we rejoin the EU?
No, I'm not sure about that, but I think it is extremely difficult for Britain to come out from under the dependence that we have in the defence field on the United States, which is to a different degree to that of any other European country. And we're seeing these problems emerge again. Well, just today, when the French have announced that they wish to put a cap on the degree to which the British companies can participate in the European rearmament program that is now underway.
How far do you think that there's an impact of this strategic, geostrategic dependence on domestic British politics? How far do you think reform are helped by their association with the United States and particularly with the personality of Trump? Seems to me that that might well be a rather two-edged weapon because, as you know, and as we've seen at the beginning of this state visit, Trump is personally very unpopular in the United Kingdom. And the sort of philosophical approach of MAGA is equally one with its hostility to the welfare state and the National Health Service, equally one that's uncongenial to wide swathes of British public opinion.
Well, this is, I think, the big question. Certainly, reform is about making Britain much more like America in a whole range of ways, including, curiously, immigration, because the effect of Brexit on immigration has been to reduce the number of people from the EU coming and replacing EU citizens essentially with non-EU citizens. And in that sense, making Britain a less European country and one which is much more varied and therefore much more like the United States, which is entirely an immigrant society. But it's the economic dimension which is most important. The backers of reform, both those who are in fossil fuel interests, but also more widely the hedge fund area, the financial area, which fears European regulation, fears the EU, and therefore wishes to be much closer to America. Those are the power behind reform's rise and the funding of reform. And that is a very powerful lobby. Of course, their interests are not necessarily the same at all as those of the wider British public. But that doesn't mean that they cannot succeed and they cannot prevail. The same can be said of the takeover by Trump and the MAGA movement of the Republicans in the United States. The people who are voting for Trump are actually those who are likely most to suffer from his economic and tax policies. That's the irony of the current situation. And everything, in my view, depends on how the British public view the MAGA revolution, which is now underway in America. If they view that, or if it is possible for that to be presented as a success, as a proof of strong government, as order, of stopping immigration, of defending national identity, or whatever. I mean, these catchphrases that will be thrown out, and which we saw, of course, on the streets of London at the weekend. If that notion of what is happening in America prevails, then reform will likely form the next government in the United Kingdom. If, however, the American MAGA experiment fails, if it fails economically, if it's seen to be essentially a move towards creating a retreat from democracy in America, an authoritarian government, a descent into tyranny, if that is the perception that emerges from America over the next couple of years, then that will be the end of reform. And that's really what this turns on. For the first time, for a very, very long time in our history, we are no longer really driven by events that are domestic. We are hugely influenced by what happens now in the United States.
Parallel between the United States and the United Kingdom isn't exact in one way, because Donald Trump did win for his presidential candidature a majority of the people voting. That won't be necessary at all for Reform to be the biggest party or even to have a majority in the next House of Commons. Would you like to speculate about any possibilities that proportional representation from a great majority of people who are likely to be hostile, even in the circumstances you describe, to reform, how will their votes be made to count under the present first past the post system?
Well, you're absolutely right. It is very difficult to see reform commanding more than a third of the votes in the United Kingdom. But that, of course, is quite sufficient under our current system to win a governing majority. And the mismatch between the outcomes that our current electoral system provides and the real votes that have been cast is becoming increasingly grotesque. That seems to me to be now the central issue in stopping reform, is to bring in a change in the electoral system, which would also, I think, involve a comprehensive reform of Parliament, including the House of Lords. But whether the Labour government has got the courage to undertake that now, it's in a very severe crisis, there's no question of that. That is a different question. That's a different matter.
But can you see somebody other than Starmer perhaps using his or her immense parliamentary majority in a more courageous and more constructive way along the lines that you describe, if in the not too distant future Starmer were replaced as leader of the Labour Party and therefore a new Prime Minister entered number 10?
I think Starmer could well do it himself because he is obviously in a very desperate situation now. And that calls for very desperate measures. And there are very powerful arguments in favour of changing the electoral system beyond the obvious fact that the current system is not delivering a democratic result. The foundation of reform's appeal is that it is a fundamental change. There is a sense out there in very widely in public opinion that the system in some way has failed. And that is far more important than any of the policies, I think, even immigration, that reform is currently pushing. This sense of this desire for that the system is broken and needs to be radically reformed. And of course, a change in the electoral system coupled with a complete remaking of the House of Lords and putting it into a democratic format, that would constitute a fundamental reform. Now, whether that would be a sufficient change to allow the Labour Party to take on the mantle of radical change and answering this hunger for change that is the foundation of reform's appeal, that remains to be seen. But certainly it's got a chance of doing that. If nothing is done, of course, nothing will alter, and reform is likely to be the victor of the next election.
I personally wouldn't go so far as to say likely to be, but certainly in with a very substantial
Well, the
chance.
problem, if I could just come in on that, I mean, the
One
problem.
shouldn't underestimate the ability of Farage in the medium term to put people off, both within his own party and in the public more generally.
That is true, but the problem which the government faces is not just reform's position in the opinion polls now, which would be sufficient for them to win an election. Maybe that would fade and they wouldn't be able to secure a majority. But the real problem is that the Conservative Party, as it's currently constituted, which is completely drifting and without any sense of direction, would on all plausible scenarios, whatever is left of it after the next election, 40, 50, 60 seats, something like that, which current polling shows, would form a coalition with Reform. That's the problem, and the Ulster unionists as well. And it's that combination which is dangerous. It's not just the fact that Reform is riding high in the polls and is obviously beginning to attract Conservative MPs. I mean, the Kruger defection. So I think one has to face the fact
Factor
that
in that
Reform
possibility.
is in a very strong position right now. And only, in my view, only electoral reform can be sure of creating circumstances in which such an extremist movement could not command a governing majority on its own.
One other thing that the Europe minister said or implied was that the Labour Party might at some stage in the not too distant future be interested in the possibility of seeking to rejoin the single market and or the customs union. Do you think there's any realism in that prospect?
No, I don't. I think the only way you can rejoin the customs union and the single market is to rejoin the EU as a whole. And the EU is becoming, under the pressures of Trump, under the pressures of Putin and Ukraine, it is becoming a much tighter entity. And the defence dimension will massively enhance that. And that is why you're seeing, for the first time, serious discussions both in Norway and in Switzerland of a need to actually outright join the EU, which is a remarkable development, driven principally, in the case of Norway, certainly, by security concerns and by the realization that a NATO without the Americans is essentially an EU institution. And in the case of Switzerland, it's the impact of the Trump tariffs, which has shown the extreme vulnerability of their economy, in financial services, in pharmaceuticals, and in high-end engineering, to pressures of that kind. And that unless they have the security of being fully part of a European market, they are in a very difficult position.
It's strange, isn't it, that the one policy, the one event with which Nigel Farage and the people who think like him is specifically associated, namely Brexit, which more and more people are coming to realise has been a flop, that seems to be a taboo area for the Labour government because the Labour government has renounced any hope of rejoining the European Union. They're estopped from bringing home to Farage and his cronies the damage they've done through Brexit to the United Kingdom. It's a paradoxical situation.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the key advantage that a Trump government gives to reform is precisely that it is exempted from any serious criticism about Brexit, because the government feels that as we said at the beginning, that the government can't move in or speak sympathetically at all about the membership of the EU because of the hostility towards the EU in the current Washington administration. And there is no other force in British politics that seems ready to address that. And the Liberal Democrats seem to be playing with the idea of embracing a hostility towards Trump. And Ed Davey, I see, is not going to the state dinner. But I mean, one needs to do rather more than that if one is going to be a serious challenge to reform. And the problem is that reform cannot really be attacked very convincingly from the centre left. If in terms of addressing it, the political threat that it poses, because its appeal is very much on the right, the absence of a pro-European centre-right force in British politics is the key weakness and the key opportunity for reform. It is the division of the left, and it is the fact that there is no serious anti-Brexit force able to speak out from a centre-right position. And of course, the real question over the introduction of proportional representation, if that were to come, is would it split the Conservative Party and allow the creation of a return to what was traditional conservatism of a broadly pro-European position?
Yes. Well, Neither of us are invited are going to the Trump dinner either, so we'll share Ed Davies' attitude to that very cheerfully. Thank you very much. When do you think we're going to rejoin the European Union?
I think it could be by the end of this decade.
By the end of this decade, I think you 2020s. I think it'll be the beginning of next decade, but those who live longest will know most. Thank you very much indeed, John. Thank you.